Good evening, everyone. I am delighted that we are here for this lecture and for Catherine Basham's giving us a sense of the richness of the scholarship and commitment she has made. This lecture is a result of a sabbatical year, but a long trajectory of work in the area of dealing with the needs of service members and their families. As professor co-director of the PhD program and editor of the Smith College Studies in Social Work, Dr. Catherine Basham engages in research, writing, clinical social work practice, and education related to the effects of deployment and combat stress on the reintegration of service members, veterans, and their families. Dr. Basham earned both her MSW and PhD degrees in clinical social work. She has been appointed to three congressionally mandated committees with the Institute of Medicine at the National Academies of Science, charged to explore issues related to enhancing the mental health treatment of military and veteran families. The current four-year committee that is producing two published texts focuses on the evaluation of efficacy of treatment of PTSD with service members, veterans, and their families. In this setting, Dr. Basham co-authored four texts published by the Institute of Medicine, National Academies of Science. Titles include PTSD, Diagnosis and Treatment, Physiologic, Psychological, and Psychosocial Effects of Deployment-Related Stress with Gulf War Veterans in 2008, Provision of Mental Health Counseling under TRICARE in 2010, and this past year, the Assessment of Ongoing Efforts in the Treatment of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. I think what's important to note is that in the work that she has been doing, she has often been the only clinical social worker among an interdisciplinary team. And she has held the voice of the field and the expertise of the field extraordinarily well and is represented by the fact that she keeps getting invited back to serve on these committees. In earlier years, she published with Dr. Dennis Mills a text entitled Transforming the Legacy, Couples Therapy with Survivors of Childhood Trauma. She's also focused her scholarship on intercultural practice and pedagogy and diversity. She has authored and co-authored numerous papers on these topics and has presented in both national and international forums, including Walter Reed National Medical Center, several Veterans Administration medical centers, the Canadian Forces Social Work Corps, Austin Riggs Institute, and various professional organizations. Dr. Basham served on a major task force of the Council for Social Work Education to design military social work competencies and participated on the expert panel of NASW to design credentials in military social work at the BSW, MSW, and advanced clinical MSW levels. She is an active participant in the national interdisciplinary organization, the Alliance for Military and Veterans Family Behavioral Health Providers. Dr. Basham has been awarded a distinguished clinical practitioner with the National Academies of Practice and maintains a clinical practice in Northampton, Massachusetts, specializing in clinical social work practice with individuals and couples and families, supervision and consultation. What I would say about Catherine is, as I really worked on reinstituting, reengaging the school much more actively in our commitment to service members and their families, she has been just very much there as a strong advocate and as someone who has really put the school on the national scene in regards to the excellence in clinical social work education that we provide here. She has represented us well and has done just an extraordinary job for the profession. And so I ask that you join me in welcoming Dr. Basham to speak on women and the military, rewards and challenges.
Good evening to everyone. Thank you very much, Carolyn, for your kind remarks. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, good. Well, women in the military. I have this here just to set the stage for some calm as we move ahead throughout this presentation. I'd first like to thank a number of people. So I was thinking about this particular topic, and think of the idea that it takes a village to present a lecture. Well, yeah. I would like to thank a number of women in the military who've been of particular support to me in consultation. Dr. Camille Hall, who's teaching the Beyond Combat class this term, teaching two sections of it. And I'm also very happy to be thanking Major Deborah Stone. She's one of our MSW alumni who actually served both in Iraq and in Afghanistan as a clinical social worker embedded with her particular unit. Then I'm also interested in thanking retired Colonel Cameron Ritchie, who's an Army psychiatrist at Walter Reed Army Medical Center for a good 2 decades, the chief of the Department of Psychiatry. This is no small feat for a woman to be a colonel in that setting. So I share this talk with you tonight, and thank you for your wisdom. People often wonder, why am I in this field? And I only figured that out some time ago, but it wasn't fully evolved until, I'd say, 10 years ago. Because I was reared in a family in New York City, and my father had served in World War II on the Burmese-China front. He was a newly minted physician at the time, sent off to war. He had had very little practice experience, if at all. And he was in a field hospital, which consisted of a tent, no running water. And he was there for 2 years, and no, very little contact, if you remember, with the World War II vets back home. And he basically tended to the wounded combat veterans, as well as the veterans and the local community members who were suffering from tropical diseases. So upon return to life in New York, I was the post-deployment baby. So, and we think about what are the effects, sort of some of the intergenerational effects, both positive and negative. So vulnerabilities and strengths, rewards and challenges. That's the talk that I'm offering today as well, women in the military. But my early years were certainly formed by these experiences. And my father never talked about it until I harassed him at about age 18 and insisted upon hearing about stories, and then he finally relented and started telling some various experiences that he had had. But his basic message to me was, don't push. If people do not want to talk about these issues, do not insist. And that was a clear message. Be respectful of the pacing for people in talking about difficult experience. He said he saw too much death. And upon return, his hope was to distill some of the most positive experiences during the war. And so growing up in New York, my friends always asked me, why everyone in your family, whenever we come to visit you, all of the meals are curry, Indian curry and Burmese curry and music from the Far East. And I said, well, I have no idea, frankly. This is when I was little. And then I realized that even though I was Lithuanian, Hungarian in background, that we had adopted some different cultural backgrounds. So this was a way of trying to distill some of the really important features of the legacies of war. So I just thought I would let you know. Then I lived in D.C. for 20 years, where I worked and practiced and also saw many military and civilian families. So this is a depiction of some of the differences between women in the military between 1943 and 2013. Can you see what she is holding? I don't know if you can see it, but it's an MRE, Meals Ready to Eat, as compared with Rosie the Riveter. She is currently in combat gear. So I'm going to be talking about what are the challenges, stressors, and rewards for women who have served in the military, and then how does research inform our understanding of the effects of deployment and combat on women who have served in the military. The role of gender in the military is absolutely crucial. We're just thinking of, I'll amplify that as we go throughout this talk. I want to look at what are the balance of risk and protective factors in coping with deployment and traumatic stressors. Then we're looking at what are the psychosocial adjustments for women in the military as they return home and reintegrate. What are the issues with physical health and well-being? What are the mental health issues, specifically military sexual trauma? And then some of you, yes, bear with me, but you know the mantra. I find that it's important to think about what do we need to do in clinical social work practice. Some of the major features that I've considered in this model is to think about relationally based, culturally responsive, theoretically grounded, research-informed clinical social work practice. So let's talk a little bit about history. Women have served in the military for a very long period of time. With the War on Independence in 1775 to 1783, mothers, wives, daughters basically joined the forces and cooked and washed clothes and tended to the wounded. Then here, this picture is depicted in the Civil War, disguised as a man. On the right, Francis Clayton served many months in Missouri, the Missouri Artillery and Cavalry Units in the Civil War. This was not uncommon, and when detected, actually usually they would be banished and often punished, but it was very common for women to be serving in combat positions during that time. Then in 1901, Congress established the Army Nursing Corps, and several years later the Navy Nursing Corps. So women have been acknowledged in different service roles throughout decades. At the end of World War I, 49,000 women had served as nurses, clerks, typists, and telephone operators. However, when they returned from the war, they lost their jobs. Mostly they had lost their jobs that they had previously held. They had no benefits, so there was no equity in terms of their rights as service members. That was during the time, World War I, you know, we often hear the origin of the school in 1918, where our social work students were actually sent to their internships were in Eastern Europe and Germany at the time. So it's quite incredible when you think, those of you who are students, if you think of traveling just to California, this was a very different experience. It was a combination of clinical social work and helping the actual service members who were dealing with shell shock, as well as nursing. So let's fast forward. In Vietnam, you're all very familiar. Again, women were serving in many medical roles and nursing roles, but you also see a major presence in terms of support positions. In the 1990s, that's when women were actually flying airplanes and serving on ships, driving convoys. You hear the increasing degree of combat exposure as we have gone through the decades, and clearly within the last decade, you see equity in terms of their experiences. So if you can see the comments here. Okay, ladies, you've been equipped with helmets and body armor as we await orders to break through the glass ceiling. Some of you have probably heard of this news, certainly. It was just this year, which is pretty astonishing, that in January of this year, women were basically acknowledged as serving in combat. The combat-related ban was lifted when the Pentagon released news that this seemed to be. Basically, what they had to determine was that by actually allowing women to be in combat roles, that it would not undermine the readiness of the forces. So the claim was this took a while. But if you hear the history of the women in combat, this does seem, certainly did not make a lot of sense. Okay, this is a slightly different scenario because most women who I've talked with in the military, they don't want to be viewed as vulnerable and different from their male counterparts in terms of their jobs. They don't want to be seen as victimized or pitiful or somehow less than. They want to be equal in terms of rights and pay and opportunities for advancement. I just want to talk about the notion of gender as well, because when you're thinking about, do you want to be completely equal, then is there room for difference? In the military, one of the most important notions is that there's a universality of values. And then people would often say, well, why am I interested in military social work? Well, if you look at the values in the military, they're directly compatible with a social work code of ethics. If you hear the sense of loyalty, pride, dedication, self-sacrifice, duty, honor, support of each other, self-determination, these are parallels with social work values. So if there's a world of universality during combat, it is important for the service members to pull together because they're united, they're defending, they're protecting each other. This is not the time for diversity or differences. That's when people talk about an esprit de corps. But in the women in the military, on the one hand, is there a way to assert the need for advancements in civil rights while also recognizing that there are differences. Women experience combat and deployment stressors in a different way. So it's a both and that I'm hoping to convey today. And here, change, yes. As of January of this year, this is very important that women are acknowledged in combat because now they can have opportunities for equal pay, advancement, and benefits. That's all been denied, even up until this past year. But I love this cartoon here. Real change, women deciding about combat. Do you see the pool table? It has all the munitions and different activities. So I'll try not to go into too much detail because it could be mind-numbing, and at 7:45, that's not a good thing. I think it's important. I'm always reminded I want to look at the demographics and some of the data on this population because it's so compelling when you hear the number and also the situation. And again, think of the both end. There's some similarities between male and female service members. There are differences. So total number of all service members, over 2.2 million service members have been deployed since 2001. Okay, 820,000 National Guard, 96,000 reservists. That's a daunting number. Okay. With women, 15% of the current OAF stands for Operation Iraqi Freedom. OEF stands for Operation Enduring Freedom, which occurred in Afghanistan. Of this population of active duty armed forces, they're 15% of the total forces. And that has been an increase in recent years. Children, 1.3 million dependent military children have been affected by deployments throughout these last 10 years. Again, I acknowledge the importance of thinking about previous era veterans, which is incredibly significant in terms of the work that we're doing, particularly in the VA systems. But I am deliberately focused on the OIF, OEF active duty. And then there's the group of the OND. This is the group that was in Iraq since 2010 when troops were withdrawn and the nature of combat changed. Okay, what do you think of this statistic? 60 million family members have been affected by deployments and combat exposure. And 57% of active duty service members, think of this one again, 57% of all active duty service members have primary family responsibility of a spouse, children, and or a dependent. That's daunting, isn't it? That we think of, just it's worth noting. In terms of just the trends in the field, there's an increase in Hispanic and new immigrants and a decrease in African-American troops. So I want to, again, listen to some of these data and just think of the implications of a voluntary armed forces. In terms of race, in terms of the current troops, 70% self-define as white. 17% has African-American, but that's including Hispanics. 4% Asian, and when people are asked to report their ethnicity, they actually say 18% are Hispanic origin. That's a significant number and also growing number in terms of concentration. When you think of the forces, and that exists both in enlisted as well as officer corps. In terms of marriages, with active duty men, 59% are married. A heterosexual marriage, and 46% of women are married. If you switch to the National Guard, 50% of men are married, 37% of women. You hear the drop? So again, just in terms of the data, there are more women who are single in the military. They're caregivers of children, parents, and other family members. Then we move on to the rates of divorce. The rates of divorce between service members and general community are pretty much the same. However, the rates for women in the military are 2 times the risk of having a divorce as compared to civilians. In terms of unemployment, this is a daunting set of data as well. 12% of veterans at this point are unemployed compared to the 7.4% rate. But if you look at just the age range between 18 and 24, the percentage of veterans who are unemployed kicks up to 30%. This is really significant. If you start actually reviewing the seriousness of these data, these are unemployment. These are these service members returning home, separated from the military, looking for work, or that may be the reservists or the guard who had their jobs and have lost their jobs. Homelessness. Generally, the rates of homelessness are quite dramatic for veterans. It's 14% for men of all veterans, 2% for women. So the number of women veterans who are homeless is lower. But then I went further. You can tell it was a little obsessional exercise here, but I went further with this investigation. And in this last year, 21,800 women were homeless. These are OIF veterans, but just within the last few years. That's a very daunting number. And they're right in our backyard, homeless. So when you think about the U.S. and talking about our role in the military, talk about the floating display of U.S. pride, do you remember that, the Intrepid? And then the sinking display of U.S. pride, homeless vets. So this is another significant change in the military. For those of you who know about the reversal, don't ask, don't tell. Because if you noticed what was missing in my data analysis there of the demographics, who knows how many gay and lesbian and bisexual service members or veterans are there. We have a better counting for veterans because they may feel more open to disclose their sexual orientation. But again, in order to go through with the reversal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in April 2011, President Obama, the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, retired Admiral Mullen, they certified that the lifting of the ban would not jeopardize troops. This is sort of in the writing of the language. So, yeah, hope I'm not a distraction to you boys. No, ma'am, we're married to each other. So what we don't know right now is really the experiences of, you can't sort of track some of the experiences for those service members and who are identifying as a gay, bisexual, or lesbian unless we start sort of helping them to express their identity, because even though this has been 2 years out into this new world of supposed disclosure, there are still lots of homophobic and other harsh experiences that people are subjected to. Okay, so why do I have this up here, the biology of traumatic stress? I'm going to shift into talking about different themes that are particularly pertinent to women in the military then. And I'm not going to go over the typical reaction of a traumatic stress response. Okay, I will a little bit just because, but I think many of you know this. I'm going to give you a brief clinical vignette later in the talk today. But I'll introduce you to Sergeant Sanchez. She served in Iraq for a year as a medic, and actually, this is her brain at this moment. This is Sergeant Sanchez. And during combat, she actually witnessed many explosions, and she was in the directly sort of involved in an IED blast of a truck. Sort of about 100 sort of meters ahead of her, carrying a number of her buddies in her unit. And a young man who's a private who she had taken under wing, only 18 years old, was killed. And at the time, she ran to the truck, the blazing truck with on fire, and tried to rescue him. She herself suffered first and second degree burns in that effort, and he died in her arms. So this represented a horrific experience for her. But when people think about, remember when those events occur, the brain, the thalamus receives stimuli, it receives stimuli of smells and sounds and the feel of the air, sort of all sorts of visual stimuli that are disturbing. At the moment, Sergeant Sanchez is overwhelmed. She's not able to really process the event of the blast, even though she's running toward the blast to try to save him. Her body is in full sort of state of alert. So her thalamus is stimulated, and you know that the amygdala is the alarm system that signals the call for the sympathetic and parasympathetic systems to activate both the enervation and the innervation, right? The revving up and the drawing down at the same time. So for her, the hippocampus was not recording any memories at the time. She was just on autopilot, just totally in an adrenaline rush, rushing to save this young man. And we usually think of this as fight, flight, and freeze. Remember, that's the typical phenomenon we think of with traumatic stress response. But there's some research that's been done over the last numbers of years at UCLA with Taylor and colleagues. And what's interesting is there is a hormone that's released, that there are studies between gender differences between men and women. And many women actually produce higher levels of the hormone, which is called oxytocin. And oxytocin induces desire for connection, calm, tenderness, pro-social behavior, bonding, trust, and reduced fear and anxiety. Very interesting, isn't it? That's different from fight, flight, freeze. So what was Sergeant Sanchez doing at that time? There needs to be more research to validate those findings, but it seems pretty evident that she may have been, she ran toward that. She did not. She didn't freeze, she didn't fight, she didn't flee. Now again, she's a medic, so you'd say, well, maybe that's her training. But it seemed that it might be something we should think about. Are there gender differences? And again, when we talk about differences, we always have to be careful. Let's not be stereotypical. I'm not suggesting that men would not have this similar response as well. And just thinking of these, some of the research data that support some of these differences. Okay, so when you think about the effects for many of these families, there's no such thing as a deployment cycle any longer. There's no just one deployment cycle. They're recurrent deployment cycles. So particularly many members of the Guard and Reserves, as well as active duty, are all in pre-deployment, deployment, sustainment, post-deployment. And just think of how that works. They may be home for a period of months to year or further, but then redeploy, return home, redeploy, return home. So the multiple separations, reunions, and strains are enormous in terms of adjustments and reintegration. You think of this is going to be some of the effects of combat trauma. This is more universal, that this is often what people talk about in terms of some of the fears and stressors for both men and women in combat. An unsafe environment, exposure to combat and violence, exposure to dead and mutilated bodies. This is an important one, loss of hope, sense of purpose. That's crucial because that can determine effectiveness in all these other areas. Deprivation, that is just not having some of the same comforts that one would have normally in one's life. Separation, this one is very interesting because when there are a number of reports that the Army does each year, and they actually interview service members in the field, in theater, and they do focus groups, and the separation from family and community is as strong a stressor as the exposure to combat and violence, which I think people don't often think that, but that's what they're saying out there in the field. Fear and survivor guilt is often very palpable. And there's another one. I was just citing some of the data, but there's a new phenomenon that's extremely important. I should go back to that for a minute. Very important in terms of the effects of combat trauma. It's called moral injury, that people often are experiencing the sense of challenge to their own code of ethics, if they have their own sense of their rules of conduct and the rules of war. and either they feel they have violated in some way, or if they feel they see their fellow service members or command violating certain codes, they can suffer a tremendous sense of, you know, sort of despair and what's called moral injury. It's very interesting because actually in talking with people, that seems to be more predominant now than PTSD. Depression, moral injury, and then moral injury, if that is unrelenting, leads to suicidal thinking. So, okay, I didn't want to leave you on that note. Most service members, and I would say, just want to go back to what we know, most service members return with out major mental health outcomes or problems. It's very important that we focus on resilience and protective factors. And so that just needs to be the backdrop. Working in this field for so many years, I'm so struck by people with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 deployments, and there are those individuals, service members and families, who look relatively unscathed from the events, meaning that they're not suffering some of the mental health impact. And so I want to focus briefly on the protective factors, because how do people weather the storms? Proactive coping, we know about training and leadership. This is relevant just to sort of military and combat, because we know a lot about survivors of sexual and physical abuse in childhood and domestic violence in adult life, but this is crucial. For those units who've had more cohesive training and more of a sense of collaboration, and command that they can really trust and value, they fare much better, much, much better than those who, it's common sense, if they don't trust their, you know, fellow service member, they're not going to be in a position of some safety zone, a psychological safety zone. Family and social support, those are standard resilience factors that we know about across the board. This is crucial because I talk about this topic in a lot of different settings, and the focus is mostly on the individual service member still. You know, we are a program that specializes in clinical social work practice, so I'm leaning toward talking about the clients that we're working with who have some mental health or psychosocial concerns, their issues. And in that realm, the predominant narrative is individual. The family and social support I have to emphasize regularly. In the more general communities I'm working on bases or in posts throughout the country, there is a huge amount of attention to family and social support, more in terms of prevention and resilience building. So this complex intersecting social identity is another protective factor. Basically what that means is if a service member has a strong sense of military identity or veteran identity, and that is tied in with whatever their other identities are in terms of sociocultural or family identities, they weather these situations better. The risk factors you probably know, they're pretty well known in the field in dealing with combat. The service members who are younger, lower socioeconomic status, lower ranking, female gender, and previous mental health issues have increased risk for mental health outcomes. That doesn't mean they're going to have them, but it's just a risk factor. It has to be counterbalanced with the protective factors. This is a tricky one, the previous mental health issues. We talk about childhood trauma. There's a lot of talk in this field, military, DOD, Department of Defense settings or VA settings. Because most of the data suggests if there's childhood trauma, then that's a big risk factor for mental health problems in the field. That's been contradicted by some research that's coming out of Rachel Yehuda, she's working at the Bronx VA now, and her research suggests she's comparing some of the service members who've suffered childhood trauma and those who haven't, and looking at the differences in combat. The ones who had childhood trauma who resolved their issues and demonstrated some mastery and some sense of perspective do better in combat. So I think it's a very important finding. I don't have that right here, but it's Rachel Yehuda. This is an important one. A physical injury, any of these service members who've been injured in combat, they have three times the risk of developing PTSD. So you must be familiar with the notion of secondary trauma, because this applies to family members of people who have been exposed to combat. But it's not just the family members. Guess who also is going to be exposed to listening to narratives of traumatic events in working in this field, or actually, you know, any of us here in clinical social work are dealing with exposure to traumatizing events, hearing about them, and we are susceptible to developing secondary trauma, meaning that we may develop some symptoms that are very similar to what the person involved is dealing with in terms of having been directly traumatized. So there might be symptoms of hyperarousal, agitation, poor sleep, detachment, numbing, all of the above. I remember Jonathan Shea said a couple of years ago at our conference that we had on the Combat Stress Conference here in 2008, and he said that he sees it as an occupational hazard, you know, to actually work in this field when you're working with traumatized clients, so that every employer should basically provide health insurance that specifically attends to secondary trauma and plans. You know, part of the insurance plan would be actually providing for yoga and other sort of regular massages and other, you know, avenues for reducing stress. So I just thought I'd share that. Actually, in some settings, I've noticed they've done it, and it's been impressive when you see it in operation. So what does secondary trauma do? It sets the stage for affecting children and family members. There are a lot of data, unfortunately, to support that there are higher rates of marital conflict, intimate partner violence, and effects on children. Okay, this is an important theme. We're talking about the caregiving, because for caregiving, just for a moment, remember that the data I was sharing with you, like 65% of service members are then caring for a child or family member. So when they're returning home, they're going to be dealing with that responsibility. So rather than just assuming it's caregiving burden, which is that people often talk about caregiver burden, which of course is important because of the secondary trauma, there's also caregiving satisfaction, that they're, you know, there's more work in that area now, looking at caregiving satisfaction and post-traumatic growth. So it's not just a sense of people really suffering with some of these difficult situations. So what do we know about some of women in direct, in deployment or in combat arenas? First of all, the environment, you know, people, environmental stressors, when people often talk about, how about 200, you know, 125, or almost like last week, 130 degree heat that's insufferable, sand, you know, blinding sand, insects, all sorts of toxins that could be problematic. These are sort of just the physical environmental stressors that are very important. Also, many of the service members coming back have major sleep problems. When you think about some of the issues, one of the major physical issues is insomnia. And so if you have insomnia, you cannot sleep because you have been preoccupied with all these environmental stressors and also worried that you're going to be injured or killed, or your buddies would be injured or killed. Sleep is not an easy phenomenon. And that, at Walter Reed, that's what I found fascinating, that the first thing they do is try to get people, service members, on a sleep regimen to regulate it, because they cannot cope effectively, and also lack of adequate sleep enhances any mental health problems. It also can create. If you don't have adequate sort of deep sleep and adequate alpha sleep, it can actually induce some psychotic sort of experiences. So don't mean to scare people, but it is an important phenomenon. Then many women, we're actually talking about women in the military, so majority are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, so dealing with menstruation can be very difficult. Hygiene, limited restrooms. I found this interesting. There was one study that suggested 20% of the women who were interviewed a very large sample of reported unintended pregnancies. And what happened is, I wonder, well, why is that? Well, sometimes the birth control was not available in the same way. So it's just more difficult to take care of oneself and be able to manage sort of basic gynecological care. I also talked to one woman who's saying, do you know what it's like to go through menopause in, 130-degree heat and also trying to serve and do your job and maintain your fitness and do your fitness routine every day? Yeah, okay, well, no, I don't know, but I can imagine. So childbirth and nursing, that's very interesting because, you know, usually when somebody's pregnant, they're no longer deployable, but if they're pregnant in theater, then they have to find out they're pregnant, and then they usually are sent home. Sometimes if they're sent home, then other members in the unit resent them because then somebody else has to do their job. So if a man and a woman, heterosexual couple, are dealing with a pregnancy, the man is not dealing with problems with deployment. It's the woman in the military who's dealing, has negative consequences. The nursing was very interesting. This is Colonel Richie, who I was telling about at Walter Reed. When she was on she was very focused on this effort in the early 2000s to make sure that nursing sailors at the time, women sailors, would be able to provide for nursing for their babies when they were on ships. And she set up this elaborate program, which was very important. She said that as long as the command would provide enough time, you have to have time and spacing and support, that you would allow the mother to be able to express milk, save it, and actually nurse her baby over time. This sounds so, would seem so basic, right, if you think of people who are back home. So, but what happens with a nursing mother who then would have to automatically stop nursing or not even be with the baby? In some deployments, the baby is somewhere else, back home with other family members. So that's a stressor. Okay, mental health responses. These are the ones that are familiar to us who are doing the clinical work. I do so much, these committees I'm on are focusing on post-traumatic stress now and PTSD over and over and over and over and over. But as I said, the depression, moral injury, and suicidal thinking is really as significant as PTSD. They're both significant. The scary thing for women in the military is that the rates actually are higher for women than men in terms of post-traumatic stress. I mean, we have that validated now over years. With depression and suicidality, that's not the case, though. Women are do not suicide at the same rates as men, service women. However, when you think of just the general data, you might find this important because it's rather grim compelling some meaning that we should do something about it. Last year, there were 349 suicides just in the Army, and there were 295 deaths in combat. So the numbers of suicides are higher than the numbers of deaths, which is pretty daunting. So when you think of with every era, any combat era, there are different issues that are central, and with the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, the issues that have existed are, they're called signature injuries. They're a cluster. They're not just one. It's not just PTSD or depression. It's PTSD. I say post-traumatic stress or PTSD. Most people coming back are going to suffer some post-traumatic stress. I would argue that any of us in combat, we're going to have post-traumatic stress because it's a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances. So there's symptoms, but it's not full-blown PTSD. But this cluster of post-traumatic stress, depression, suicidal thinking, substance abuse, traumatic brain injury, and intimate partner violence, they go hand in hand. And you see the incendiary effect of that. This is why we in our field need to be mindful not just of the service member, but then the impact on the family. So this, you're familiar probably with PTS, the clusters of re-experiencing, avoidance, and hyperarousal. If you think of in families, which of these themes are most difficult for children? Early on in my work here, I thought it would be hyperarousal because that's scary when family members, elevated and augmented and mad and rage storms and, really scary presence. But that's not the case. Children desperately respond negatively to the avoidance and numbing. It has a really powerfully negative effect. So we'll talk a little bit about military sexual trauma. The Pentagon data of May of this year is that 26,000 service members were assaulted in the last year compared with 19,000 the year before. And those of you probably know that with all the attention that has been paid in recent months in the Senate hearings, the messages are coming forward, and I think there's much more attention. People are paying attention. One in three women in military assaulted compared to one in six civilians. And that's sort of a general sort of number at this point. But again, that's very daunting. We're talking about assault, not harassment. Harassment, the data on harassment are like in the range of something like 70% that people in the military suggest that they've been harassed, both men and women. It's the assault that there's more focus on in terms of the current congressional hearings. And then why would you think this? The reports, you know this, I think. The reports in the Department of Defense are lower than in VA settings, in the Veterans Administration settings. Well, if you report, one of the significant features of military sexual trauma is that often the person who has offended is maybe in your unit, maybe your superior officer, maybe the commanding officer. So then many of the women who are assaulted, and I say women because men are assaulted as well, it's not just women, it's just the focus of this talk is women. But if they are then not separated from the offending person who has injured them, they have to live with that. So not only there is a deterrent to reporting because of safety, there's a deterrent because it would affect one's job standing and any opportunities for promotion. So what we do know, though, is military sexual assault is directly associated with PTSD. This Himmelfarb conducted a study a few years ago. It examined the relations between military sexual trauma and the actual outcomes with PTSD. It's strongly associated with, rather than thinking that it's associated with trauma before the military or after the military, it's strongly associated with military sexual assault. And that's one of the major reasons that you have these high number of women who are presenting with PTSD. So what I was going to mention, I'm not going to go into much more detail with that, but Julia St. George, who's an AE-13, has been organizing a showing, which will occur next Wednesday, 7 o'clock in room 106, Sealy 106. And this is a showing, a viewing of The Invisible War. For those of you who may or may not be familiar with that, it's a documentary that won a number of awards within the last 2 years, documenting the interviews with women who have suffered military sexual assault. And it's very powerful, so powerful that it was shown to a number of the commanding officers who sat in the congressional hearings. And what I have found out since from Deborah Stone, who's the major, and she's the one who is a colleague of mine, who's working in Fort Myer in D.C. now, and she has said that the U.S. Army's SHARP training, that's this training. I have all these. If you, with this website, you can sort of log on and take a look at it. They actually have implemented very elaborate trainings about trying to change the culture in the military, and some of it's pretty basic, that both in some basic training, as well as just general sort of conversation and general discourse in the military, people are often using, misogynistic, bigoted, sort of harsh, sexist language. So that does not set the stage for, a respectful, benevolent environment, shall we say. So this is the challenge to the cultural typing that the Army has now implemented. And I was looking at some of that today, and they're taking it seriously. I hope they keep taking it seriously. And what they were saying, there was all that controversy, should they, have reporting outside of the command structure? But the conclusion, obviously, with the what they're doing now is they think they're trying to change the culture from the top, not just from the lower ranking, top down and mid-range. So we'll see. But I urge all of you to attend the viewing next Wednesday if you'd like to see and hear more about these issues in depth. So, okay, let's see. We're going to shift now because I hope I've given you a lot of these data about what some of the issues are that women are coming back with. So, as clinical social workers, how do we respond? These are some of the basic principles that I think they're all familiar to us that are critical in any type of clinical social work encounter. The value of relationship, therapeutic alliance, cultural responsiveness, a research-informed stance, theoretical grounding, and a social justice perspective. So let me just introduce you to the Sanchez family a little better, because then I hope that this will convey, it's only a clinical vignette, it's a composite, but I'm hoping that the vignette will capture some of the issues that we've just talked about that are facing many women in the military. And I'm going to urge us to think in a very broad sense. Don't think beyond just symptom relief. Think of the complexity of this client's situation. So first of all, I'd even ask you, who's the client? Because I've introduced you to Maria. I've told you a little bit about her so far, but I haven't told you about the whole family yet. So Maria is 37, was reared in Puerto Rico, in a family where she's the eldest of four children. She was reared in poverty in a very difficult, challenging home life. Her mother was very physically ill from for her early years onward. So she was caring for many of the siblings. Her mother died when she was only four. Mother died from a septic infection. So Maria was sent at a very early age. She was sent to family members in New England to live. But she was described herself as really marginalized because she was taken in by some distant relatives and they, quote, felt sorry for her. She, in her home life, had described that she was beaten by her older brother regularly. The father was very neglectful and harsh. She just had an incredibly difficult early years and managed to thrive. And you talk about the sort of nature of resilience. In her new setting in New England, she managed to go to school, get through high school, and then met Carlos. Carlos was reared Puerto Rican ethnicity, oldest of four children, and his family had lived in New England for about 40 years. Very educationally oriented, sort of solid socioeconomically, hearing the differences in terms of some of the sociocultural background. When they married, they felt the commonality in terms of religion, ethnicity, shared values. They desperately wanted to have three children, Antonio, who's now 16, Delia, who's 9, and Anna, who's 3. So they've been married 17 years, and Maria was in the Army Reserves for 8 years. She wanted to join because she wanted to continue with her schooling, and she had a sense of pride because some of the relatives in her family that adopted her and took her in had been in the military. So you hear the sense of identification that was positive for Maria. So this family, basically, you sort of think of where they were 2 years before her deployment. They were basically functioning quite well. All three kids were doing what they needed to be doing in school, sort of thriving. Carlos was an accountant, and Maria was working in a nursing home as a nurse's aide. So Maria, the unit called up, she's deployed, goes to Iraq. This is where you hear the story. Then she then had the experience of being the medic and separated from, at the time, 15-year-old, 8-year-old, 2-year-old. Think of the implications. Again, these are the ordinary stressors of deployment, but the, you know, the dramatic difference between a 2- and 3-year-old and 8- and 9-year-old and, you know, 15- and 16-year-old, it's considerable. So let me tell you what happened upon return from combat. Maria was not sleeping. She had flashbacks. She wanted to be dead. She felt that she had no reason to be living. She felt completely detached from the kids. She didn't know how to engage with them because she was getting reports from school. Antonio, the oldest, was getting into trouble. He was beating up other kids. Delia was bedwetting. She was, you know, wetting her bed every night and very anxious and not able to sleep. And Anna would shriek every time her mother would go to pick her up, and she would start screaming. So Maria felt like she had lost everything. She was no longer a decent soldier in her perspective because she was responsible, this is her words, she was responsible for the death of that young man. So she was a terrible soldier. She wasn't a decent mother. She couldn't be a decent mother to any of these children. And she felt that she failed her husband as a wife because they were fighting constantly. She was not only despairing, but she was not sleeping, angry, irritable, yelling at the kids. He was distance. He tried to spend as much time away from the home as possible. So, all right. We have enough of at least some of the cameo of the vignette. So what do you do? Who's the client? Some of you are familiar with this. This is my model that I try to use when you think about this is the client. So who's the client? Is it just Maria? Or what about Carlos? Or about the whole family? It could be an individual as a client. It could be the couple. It could be the family. I would argue that it was the whole family that was my client. And with every given client, we need to pay attention to diversity. Let's see if this shows up here. Health, trauma, and addictions. Basic developmental themes, family and community. Social policy and research. Sociopolitical context and ethics. Does that make sense? That with every single client, we need to be mindful of these themes. As well as, guess what? The client is interacting with us. So as clinicians, we're influencing this therapeutic alliance at every given moment. We need to be mindful of all of these factors as well. So going back to the case, if you were thinking of what would you do, how would you assess, and what theory models would you draw from? Did you hear in the description with Maria, with her sense, her nightmares, her flashbacks, her hopelessness, her irritability, her hyperarousal, you're hearing pull for trauma theory, right? Pulls for trauma theory. You're hearing the incredible relationship disruptions and the sense of estrangement and pulls for attachment theory. You're hearing the alienation they have again with their families of origin, they're no longer talking to them. The family theory comes to mind. So when you think of how we try to use a multiplicity of theory models, it's not random. It's actually based on what are the presenting issues and then pulling from the different theory models. So why do we care about psychodynamic theory? Well, at least in this line of work, if we really believe that there are certain patterns that are established in childhood that they're going to influence both strengths and vulnerabilities in later life, then that will affect how our female service members are going to navigate these stressors. The power of the unconscious, and then this is very important, this is the unique meaning of a narrative of an individual. Rather than assuming in many settings, the treatment programs are symptom-related. So if a client has a symptom picture of PTSD, then they may be recommended to a particular protocol that focuses on PTSD. So it might be cognitive processing treatment, it might be CBT, which would be fine, except you need to find out what's the unique meaning of the experience for the individual. Rather than just focusing on symptom picture, who's the individual? Transference, countertransference is pivotal because it tells us how we are reflecting on the work and what role that has in the work. So I use attachment theory regularly with this population because it doesn't make sense that with all the, you know, separations and reunions and disengagements and reattachments that under the best of circumstances, that couple had a secure attachment. It was earned security. The Maria had more of a disorganized attachment. I'm going to move through this pretty quickly, but if those of you who are somewhat familiar with attachment theory, you realize that they're either secure or insecure internal attachment models. And disorganized and disoriented is what Maria was dealing with as a child. She had a relatively secure attachment with Carlos by the time she went off to deployment. And their attachment systems were dysregulated based on the numbers of stressors that bombarded them. This is an important construct, the interference with mentalization, a part of attachment theory that's a capacity to actually be aware of one's feelings and reflect upon them and then be able to attune to the feelings of other people and also reflect upon them so that there's a capacity to make sense of it and meaning making. When there are enough combat and deployment stressors, this process, mentalization, breaks down as well. And think again, this is what gets interrupted when you have enough stress. The care seeking of attachment breaks down. People don't always seek care. Remember with Carlos, he wasn't seeking any care. She wasn't seeking any care from each other. They're not offering a safe haven to each other. There's no curiosity. And this is a crucial one. The circle of security is broken. That sense of connecting back to the person who or people who are most important in terms of providing comfort and security. So, how about another model for a moment? Why do we care about Winnicott? First of all, Donald and Claire Winnicott focused their entire careers on in World War II in helping children survive the Blitz, and they took them to homes outside in the countryside. And one would think, well, were these children traumatized because they were taken away from their families? No. Because they provided homes that had a good enough holding environment and good enough mothering, concepts from his model, that helped to sustain them. And when reunited with their families back in London, they navigated those separations quite well. So, victim, victimizer, bystander, why is this relevant? Anyone who has suffered trauma will know what it's like to be a victim. You've had somebody who's offended you, and there's usually a bystander who hasn't done much of anything. So why is that important? Because in families, if you think of Antonio, go back to, Carlos, excuse me. Carlos, the husband, felt like a helpless victim. He felt victimized by his partner. She felt victimized as well. Neither of them were really recognizing that they were aggressive and victimizing each other. So these themes are important in families as well as for us. As long as we reflect, we have a better chance of helping our clients. So back to the practice approaches. That those of you who work in Department of Defense and VA settings, these are probably familiar to you. These are considered the gold standard treatments for PTSD and depression, cognitive behavioral work, cognitive processing treatment, prolonged exposure. They're all CBT models. And they all have very strong validity. However, imagine with Carlos and Maria, can you imagine them focusing exclusively on these models without paying attention to couple and family therapy and other methods? Let me go back to this for a moment. Just propose, why would we want to work with families? Because I'm arguing with the need for actually working with this entire family, and it's to promote secure attachments, help them reconnect, reduce the mental health symptomatology, minimize secondary trauma, help them with learning more, and then restoring a sense of reconnection, social vindication. So this is a trauma-informed model that I've been working on that's geared to military and veteran families. It's similar to a lot of trauma-informed models, where the first stage is safety, stabilization. Second, reflection on the trauma narrative. Third, consolidation of new perspectives. But what I'm going to emphasize is the attachment piece, because getting back to the case of Carlos and Maria, they needed to have a sense that there was a safe environment at home, because you hear the volatility. It wasn't clear to me if there was intimate partner violence or not. You had to do a risk assessment to establish safety. The whole realm of self-care was crucial. The affect regulation was thrown off not only for Maria, who was the combat veteran, but for her husband. Does that make sense? In their years where they had more stability, they were able to relate in really harmonious ways and to be able to self-soothe and to be able to manage their emotions without having these incredible ups and downs, rage storms. So this feature was absolutely critical. The biobehavioral strategies for stress reduction. Oh, that's repeated there. I guess I'm trying to make the point. Yeah, stress reduction, self-soothing affect regulation. This couple was completely dysregulated. So this was the major focus of the self-care. In addition, in this early phase of the work, remember the physical health? Neither of them were sleeping, not just Maria. Carlos wasn't sleeping, and the little one, Anna, wasn't sleeping, and Delia was wetting her bed. The only one sleeping was Antonio. So the whole household had problems with physical health. Mental health, you heard the issues. Maria needed to have a referral for a psychiatrist to see if she needed help with sleep, depression, check out any possible suicidality. And she was also drinking several glasses of wine, two or three, four glasses of wine a night. So she had to be checked. This is where you can pull in. If you are the clinician who's actually providing at this moment you're providing a supportive psychotherapy role. You're doing an extended assessment and building a therapeutic alliance. Well, connecting with this whole cast of characters, the psychiatrists, physicians, nutritionists, other clinicians who are working, the school system who are, the school counselors who are dealing with the children who are suffering. So, psychoeducation regarding post-deployment, this is also a piece of this. For many of couples then, the partners need just basic understanding of some of these stressors that they may have been dealing with. So once again, it's understanding, safety, and developing in attachment theory language. What they were doing is developing secure attachments and reconnections once again, so they're able to move on. Moving on means actually trying to address some of the traumatic experiences. And at that point, Maria is ready for entering cognitive processing treatment. She's in a position where she's stable enough to be able to withstand recalling the content of the horrific traumatic events. So Maria gets her own individual therapist. But what do we do in couples therapy? She starts to talk about how devastated she was of being lost and not having any role in her family, losing her husband, losing her children, losing her sense of being a soldier, wanting to be dead. And he then becomes, Carlos, much more compassionate, because at this point they are starting to talk to each other and talk about how they've missed each other, how they've lost each other. The grieving, this is a phase of grieving, and it's not just sharing of trauma events, it's the grieving of those experiences and the grieving of whatever was lost during the deployment, the lost years with these children. So this couple was actually able to go from a sense of bitter estrangement to really connecting with each other in a powerful way. Why does this matter, the pattern of victim, victimizer, bystander? Well, they were each blaming the other. She kept saying to him that he seemed so passive and hopeless and helpless and she couldn't stand it. He kept saying she was so agitated and angry and furious and hard to be around. He couldn't stand it. So they were unable to tolerate the other's qualities, and they were victimizing each other constantly, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And ultimately, as they were talking about what they had lost, what they felt they had grieved, they were able to then actually establish more of a connection. He said to her that he hated her bitterness, that she'd become a bitter old woman. She's old, she's like 38. Bitter old woman who just, you know, couldn't stand being around anymore. And she also, another part of this that happens with a lot of combat veterans, and I think it's an important phenomenon, she hadn't sounded so racist and bigoted before, but she certainly did after combat. She only had vicious things to say about anybody who looked as if they had Middle Eastern ethnicity, and family background, and she would hurl all these, you know, nasty comments and really sound quite vicious. And he said he couldn't live with somebody who was so vile and so hateful. And as she kept talking about what happened when she saw this young man killed and holding him in her arms, she said, "I hate all of them. I hate them. I hate them." And then he said to her, why are you hating an entire group of people when one person killed? And even that one person is just a human who was fighting just the way you were fighting them." And she then sank into a state of tremendous sadness and helplessness and powerlessness and fear and anxiety, and re-owned what had been projected onto him as being helpless and frightened and insecure. So do you hear the unpacking of there was an unpacking of racialized hatred? Because if people are trained to see the enemy as bad and evil and good and bad, and you kill the enemy, you don't expect that to change necessarily automatically upon homecoming. Some of those sort of deep-seated beliefs can really settle in. Now, fortunately, hers was not that deep-seated. It was the unpacking the hatred was tying in with her inability to stick with her powerlessness. And for him, what was interesting, what was he disowning? He was disowning his aggression. He couldn't recognize how furious he was with her. He was sick of having this wife who seemed so unavailable to him. And he was furious that he, from his perspective, stuck with having to take care of the three children while she was gone. And nobody complimented him on what a good job he had done. And so this period then continued on with a lot of discussion about the rage, his rage, and his frustration. So do you see the unpacking and the levels of shared expression of their feelings, which are absolutely critical for them to be able to move to more of a state of reconnection? So their attachments were beginning to be rebuilt. They began to empathize more with each other, grieve together. And one of the healing rituals had to do with her openness to accept. She was awarded a medal, a Purple Heart, for some of her sort of her heroism. She said, "I'm not a hero. I'm not a hero at all. I don't want it. Throw it out." You know. And so ultimately, they had long conversations about what that might mean, and moving along to another phase of the work, where her social identity. This is where she could sense that as a veteran, that she was going to move from being the service member to veteran. That she would feel honored by actually accepting her award. So, this is something to think about. See where we are. Maybe all of the above might be in terms of doing this work. But what I would like to say at the end here, as I think of this, I'm just thinking of why do we focus on this work and why is it so important? It would seem to me that as long as we just recognize that a client is what Winnicott would say, there's no such thing as a baby, there's just a nursing couple. There's no such thing as just a solitary service member. The service member always has to be understood in the context to whoever his or her family would be or people who are important to her. And the context is absolutely crucial. Also, if we can be holding on to complexity and thoughtfulness and working with this population, we can recognize the need to have the relationship as the underpinning of the work. And that allows for us to move slowly, going back to the idea of wait for the client to tell us what the clients really need and the pacing of the work, so that they will then help to define what do they need first. It's always self-care, safety, stabilization first, and then moving into different layers and different levels of complexity that they can bear, so that they can reconnect in ways that will really be powerful. And I would see that that's our charge with this population, and I think we will make quite a difference for many successive generations of children if we do so. So I thank you. So are there any comments or questions or reactions. Yeah, Seth? Yeah, well, I'd be curious in their ideas from the group as well, but my sense is, even with this case, I didn't highlight that, but actually for her, as a reservist, she was cut off from the members of her unit, and part of that was her detachment. She didn't want to talk with people. It was part of her avoidance. And so a good part of the work was for her to think about how important those people were to her during deployment. And she started to reconnect. But then, if there are some people who are not going to be reconnecting with the people they actually cared about, but even this, the connection with other veterans can be so powerful that's early on. People often think of that before people enter into treatment, if they need different types of psychotherapies, they often do very well vet to vet. That often have a sense of shared experience, even if they weren't deployed together. But I'm curious, is there anybody in the audience who would speak to that? Or those of you who have? Okay, any other? Oh, okay. Well, part of the victim-victimizer bystander scenario is one to think about because that resonates regularly with working with traumatized clients. And so just to give you an example, mine was the work as a couple family therapist. And again, it's disguised and composite, but it has elements of the actual case. And so I would reverberate back and forth from feeling a sense of helplessness, of thinking this family seems so devastated. The children were so, they were suffering so badly that I was glad that I had listened to the history, and that's always important to get a full history because that's what made me realize that they had tremendous promise. So I was struggling with, shall I just give up, or could I, send this couple or family to another client, send the clients to another clinician. That's a typical helplessness that we can resonate with. And then the sense of victimizing, just feeling really frustrated. I would get very angry with her when she would start making she would curse all the time, really nasty, bigoted, offensive remarks, and I would get annoyed with her. And then I would think, all right, unpack it, that you need to pay attention. What is she really saying? What's beneath the vitriol? And the bystander, as social workers, we have to be careful. We don't just try to jump in and rescue people and try to make nice and have it all, be taken care of. So that's a typical countertransference response. And then the more detached bystander is a scary one because that we can be susceptible to secondary trauma that we talked about. So that zoning out, detachment, if you're planning, your next vacation while you're sitting and working with a family like this, that's a clue of countertransference enactments. So usually the enactments have to have an action component to it, of doing something. Usually if we just sit quietly and have the experience, then we try to catch it. That was part of the self-reflection, so we don't inflict it on the clients. But even when there's an enactment, sometimes it can be helpful. Because I remember when I was annoyed with her a few times, she said, "Why are you so judgmental, Catherine?" That's just because, because I didn't like some of her language. And so she caught it. She realized I was acting on my countertransference. I wasn't just quietly sitting there. So you can use that regularly to try to understand the clients better, and then also, when necessary, repair the rupture I could have lost them if I didn't figure out. I said I was really trying to, I did find it hard to listen to because it was so nasty, but I was trying to understand what, you know, what it meant to her. And did she always have those feelings? No, I didn't have those feelings. I've only had it since I was in Iraq and back, so that was the clue. So does that, thank you for asking that because I didn't amplify that. Did everyone hear that? Just a question that, oh, so this is one family, you know, this is one deployment, and actually that, you see what can happen sometimes with one deployment, but some families, you know, four, five, six types of reunions of this sort, you know, what do you do with that? Well, some of them actually do not have these difficulties, but others do, and then that's something we need to be mindful of in doing this work. You know, I would say to proceed nonetheless, because if the family has that history of strength and desire to be together and they've had that those experiences of strong connections, then some of the these complex models can be very useful. But it raises the question about, you know, what are we doing in our country when we constantly redeploy, when we know the data suggests that this is harmful, you know, if there are enough times of this, that it's the, you know, the people in the minority maybe who have no effects, you know, who suffer no negative effects.
And the soldier may not have the effects of the family members.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like in my family, my husband doesn't have any issues, but I do.
You know. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, so the service member might not actually have some difficulties in reintegration, but the families sometimes can, and I would hope to, that we, particularly in our field, that's why I primarily talk and work with the families. I mean, I'm focusing on the women in military because that's an area that I'm interested in nowadays as well. But the families are pivotal as sources of support, and also they need assistance, our assistance, when they're suffering. So we just have, yeah. Oh, take that first. The moral injury?
Yeah.
Well, it usually occurs around some event where the service member has experienced, you know, something that they have felt that their sense of ethics, they've betrayed their own sense of ethics. And what's interesting is, even though for her this was very clear cut, she felt that she should have been able to save this young man, and so she felt that she let herself down, and it was just, you know, completely morally corrupt. But that was her view of it. Sometimes other people can actually observe something they consider, you know, egregious. You know, often the killings of children, or you know, whether deliberate or you know, sort of the so-called non-combatants who get killed in the process of war, and that can feel horrific. Just as being that's the bystander, a bystander who's watching. Sometimes the feeling of moral injury can be almost as profound as having done something oneself. So inviting that conversation, I think, is what's important. But usually, again, the timing and the pacing is so crucial, because that is such delicate territory that people have to be ready to do that. And if you notice with this couple, I was deliberately trying to convey, you have to work with that first phase, which is really bolstering strengths, helping them reconnect, reestablish attachments, and then each of them had a sturdier base. They could also regulate their moods better, each of them, so they could withstand the discussion of the because it brings up such shame and guilt, not just guilt, shame. And for her, she was able to get to a point where she could then see that she was human and mortal and humble, and she could not do it. She just had tremendous fallibility, and she hated that. But that's different from a so-called ethical defect. Yeah. Ruth, did you? How long to get to stabilization? with this particular family, just a couple of months. Because, I mean, I think if that's your goal, if your goal is to try to pay attention to what the pressing issues are, and then work, it's interdisciplinary work, though. You're coordinating with this cast of characters, and you're the anchor, trying to then provide the, it's clinical case management at its best, I think, with old Winnicottian clinical case management, where we can be in touch with a whole range of people, and so you're creating this, you know, it's the circle of security. So it's not just the partners, it's the children, it's the school, it's all the cast of characters and the professional network that need to be included as well. So, go ahead. It's mostly military sexual trauma. That's what they're saying. That that's a direct association with why those rates are significantly higher for women. Because otherwise, they are exposed then to some of the same combat stressors as men, the male counterparts. So it's not as if they're. Any thoughts about that? Anybody have thoughts about that, of why women would have more risk factors? One thing is that if people are then deployed with different units, they haven't trained with the unit, and if there's a sense of insecurity then with the other service members or the command, that's not necessarily going to cause PTSD. But when you have to look at the risk factors and the protective factors, that's the balance of the two. So you're just talking about the continuation of the masculinized culture?
Yeah.
And I didn't hear the last.
This.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See you. So you're saying, so you're hearing pockets of misogyny, and that's what I think some of the brass were talking about now, that, you know, that there's certainly going to be ongoing misogynistic attitudes, but now there's some effort to tell people, you don't talk that way, this is what harassment is, this is rape, this is assault, this is abusive talk. So, but, yeah, it seems like that persists. Maybe just one more comment, and then we're going to wrap up. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a very good point, because sometimes it's become part of the training, because we heard about some of the basic training, and it's, yeah, it's nasty stuff. It's misogynistic, it's racist, it's bigoted, it's all of the above, but it's what we might think of as sort of abusive language. But they are suggesting that one of the high rates of the military sexual assault has something to do with that sort of a generalized acceptance, that the language then can translate into behavior. You know, that sort of, like, it becomes, words become the behavior, so that type of harsh treatment doesn't. You have to set the limit and the boundary between the words and behavior, and then also adjust the language. But no easy feat here. But so I wish us all the best in working with this population. So thank you very much.